Chapter 5. Mimi.
And I didn't want to be in front lines. I didn't want to make any kind of headlines. I hated it. I grew up hating it. You know, I grew up avoiding it and hating the press. So I hated any attention on me, too. I'm not narcissistic in any way. I'm totally the opposite.
I met Michael Jackson when I was a little girl in Las Vegas. I think I was about 6. My dad was performing at the Hilton, and the Jackson 5 were playing down the road. Michael remembered that I went backstage and met them. I don't remember it at all. When I was a teenager, probably 15 or 16, Michael called my mom for her to go meet him for dinner. When I saw the messages that he'd called, I said, "Mom, what the fuck are you doing? Why is Michael Jackson calling you?" I found out later that he was hoping that I'd come with her. He didn't say so directly because he didn't want it to seem weird. Then a couple of years after that, when I was working for Jerry Schilling and helping manage Jerry Lee Lewis, Michael tried to contact me via a business guy, John Branca, who worked for the Elvis estate, but who had also helped Michael acquire the Beatles catalog. But at the time, I was about to marry Danny, so nothing came of it. Michael told me later that when I was on the cover of People magazine after Danny and I got married, he was devastated. He thought that he should be with me instead. I had no idea all this was going on. The first time meeting Michael that I actually remember was in 1993, right after he did his famous Super Bowl halftime performance and his interview with Oprah. We met through a mutual friend. I had a demo tape out. He said he'd heard it and wanted to meet me. I didn't want to go at first. I didn't want to become someone else's project. Prince had tried it too, and though I respected what they were doing, I wanted to do my own thing. But I went anyway. When Michael arrived, I was shocked that he was alone, and further shocked that he was really subdued and extremely nice. Danny was with me and made everybody leave the room so that Michael and I could talk. We just clicked. Phone numbers were exchanged, and he'd call me. I was living in Clearwater at the time, really working hard at Scientology, making progress. Back then, I wouldn't even take Advil, which is crazy. But Michael would call. We had worked out a signal. If it rang 3 times and then stopped, it was Michael, and you had to clear the fuck out of the way for me to get on the phone with him. We'd be on the phone for long periods of time. I just thought that he was lonely and needed a friend, but he was pursuing me. Eventually, he invited me to go to Atlanta to see him, and I went with my assistant, who was also Danny's brother's wife. There, I hung out only with Michael. We went to amusement parks. I don't know why Danny let me do it. Don't know why he trusted me. Mistake. This went on for a few months, and then the molestation accusations hit. Michael disappeared, went into hiding. Nobody could find him. I put the word out that I was there for him if he wanted to talk to me. He called me pretty much every other day. I was one of only a handful of people who he talked to or who knew where he was. He went to Switzerland for rehab for prescription painkillers and then ended up back in Los Angeles. That's when the Northridge earthquake happened, and I heard that Michael ran out of his house in his pajamas, jumped into his Jeep, drove to the airport, and took a Gulfstream to Las Vegas because he was terrified of earthquakes. I thought that was so funny. He called me from Vegas and invited me to join him again. I went to the Mirage where he was staying. I took the kids and my sister-in-law again. Michael and I had different rooms, but each night I'd go to his room and we'd stay up all night talking like you do when you're first meeting somebody, watching movies like Jaws, drinking and talking about our childhoods, our lives, how we felt. Michael had an energy and a presence. And that week he was fully allowing me into his world. Into his mind. I knew he didn't do that very much. I don't think he ever did, actually, until we started talking. He knew that I understood him, and we really connected because I didn't judge him. I completely got who he was and why he thought the shit that he thought. We had come from and were now in similar circumstances. Everything about our lives was so incredibly abnormal. There was no reason why we shouldn't connect. And as for that meeting as children, he remembered every detail, where I'd sat, what I'd said. He said, "You remember the white dress?" I said, "How do you remember the white dress I wore?" "My God, you remember? I don't remember any of this. All I remember was being afraid to tell my dad I wanted to go see somebody else's show. I was only supposed to go to Vegas for 2 days, but I ended up staying for 8. Nothing happened physically, but the connection was so insanely strong. No one had ever seen that side of him. He wasn't that high-pitched, calculated thing. That was an act. At one point during the week I was there, Danny flew to Las Vegas and was trying to find us in the Mirage, banging on doors. I told Danny that I was just helping Michael, being his friend, and that he should leave us alone and go home. And that's what he did. The final night, Michael again invited me to his room. When I arrived, he said, "Don't look at me. I'm really nervous. I want to tell you something." And then he turned out the lights. And in the darkness, Michael said, "I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm completely gone in love with you. I want us to get married and for you to have my children." Then he played me a song about how he felt. And when he finished, he said, "You don't have to say anything. I know I've thrown you off, but I really want you. I want to be with you." I didn't say anything immediately, but eventually I said, "I'm really so flattered, I can't even talk." By then, I felt I was in love with him too. I had told him that my marriage was in serious trouble. I was holding it all in, so when I got back to my room in the Mirage, I totally lost it. I remember walking into the closet, leaning up against the wall, and just dropping, staring. I was so infatuated, so shaken. "Oh my fucking God," I thought, "what just happened?" I hadn't wanted to tell him that I felt the same way because I had my 2 kids with me, and first I had to go home and tell my husband. But I was fully in love too. The next morning, Michael and I flew back to Los Angeles together on a private jet. When we landed, Michael said, "I'll miss you." And then he said he was leaving it to me, whatever I decided to do, and that he would call me. When I got home, Danny was in bed asleep. I was all made up. Every time I saw Michael, I had my hair done, wore an outfit, had my nails done. Everything was perfect.
The nails were fire engine red, and she'd tap them impatiently on the glass coffee table. I'd try to mimic her, but I was too little to have nails that would make a noise. My mom was a nail biter. She'd bite them down almost to the cuticle, then they'd be bloody. And she didn't want Michael to see them. She wanted to be the perfect woman for him. Michael never knew my mom smoked, for example, which again was not dissimilar to how her mother had been with her father. But after she and Michael had been together for a while, he finally told her he liked her nails the best when they were natural. He certainly didn't require her to be a perfect woman. She couldn't believe that she'd spent thousands of dollars on nails over an entire year, and he preferred the bitten ones.
So there I was, all decked out, even though I hadn't slept all night. Danny said, "Come and get in bed with me." "Actually, I can't do that," I said, and left the room. Danny came to find me. "Let's talk," he said. "What happened?" "Well," I said, "Michael asked me to leave you and marry him and have children with him." "What did you say?" "I said nothing." "That's it then," Danny said. "That's it. Forget it." And then Danny packed his bags, got the dog, and drove out the damn gate. Gone. Within a day, Michael was calling. Was I leaving Danny or not? When Michael found out what had happened, he got really excited and sent giant baskets of flowers. I started visiting him in LA. I was always in such a state, so nervous. I remember sweating a lot. He told me he was still a virgin. I think he'd kissed Tatum O'Neill, and he'd had a thing with Brooke Shields, which hadn't been physical apart from a kiss. He said Madonna had tried to hook up with him once too, but nothing happened. I was terrified because I didn't want to make the wrong move. When he decided to first kiss me, he just did it. He was instigating everything. The physical stuff started happening, which I was shocked at. I had thought that maybe we wouldn't do anything until we got married, but he said, "I'm not waiting."
I was sitting on my mom's lap in a hotel room in Clearwater, Florida, when she told me she and my dad were getting divorced. I was hysterical, sobbing uncontrollably because I thought it meant he wasn't my dad anymore. "No, no, of course he's your dad," my mom said. That day, Ben found one of her bright red lipsticks and drew a long line all along the wall. He always loved to play with her makeup, but this time, he was going to be in so much trouble. "I'm gonna tell on you," I said. And I did. I remember hearing Ben being yelled at in the other room and him crying, and I felt so guilty. I carried that guilt, the guilt of being an older sibling, for years. Ben could always break my heart. I think Michael got right at my mom's core. She wanted to fix him, and she felt he was misunderstood, a feeling she was very familiar with. My father was devastated. After the divorce from my mom, he traveled for 3 months. First around Italy on a boat with his friends, and then down to Mexico. He read a recently published poem by Bukowski, The Bluebird, and it brought my mother to mind. At one point, he got lost in a jungle while hallucinating from a drink given to him by locals, and he was rescued by a dog named Searchlight. When he came back, he had a tattoo, a black eye, and orange hair. I cried when I saw him because I could feel how much pain he was in. My brother went to his bedroom and grabbed an eraser to try and remove the tattoo.
When we walked into the lawyer's office together, Danny said, "I don't want anything." There'd been no prenup, but I said he had to take something, so I forced him to take a little bit of money. Danny was amazing like that. He never did anything to betray me. He's always been there for me. He literally filed divorce papers so that I could go marry Michael. We were best friends. We shared every single family vacation together. Riley and Ben never saw anything bad between us. We made it really great for them.
We called Michael Mimi because my brother couldn't pronounce his name. Michael was larger than life. He reminded her of her father. She told me that no one ever came close to being like her dad apart from Michael. At first, we had no idea if they were in a romantic relationship or if this was just a friend she was bringing around. I liked to joke that she was always really good at introducing her kids to the various husbands. With Mimi, as with others, we would hang out and do activities together long before she would ever tell us that they were in a relationship. I don't remember the moment she told me they were getting married, but I do recall he started sleeping over. When he would come over, her whole world would stop. The front gate would buzz, and a voice would say, "MJ is here." The drive from the gate to our house was about 6 minutes. In that time, my mom would be scurrying around to fix her lips and put her makeup on. He would come into our kitchen via the back door. Typically, the kitchen counter was covered in piles of NDAs and tabloids that her assistants would lay out for her. OK, Star, National Enquirer, Globe. So my mom could read all the cover stories about herself. But when Michael came to visit, she didn't leave the magazines out or ask him to sign an NDA. He was probably the only exception. Michael and my mother were quickly a very big deal. When significant things were happening in our lives, things that would make the press go crazy, she would take us out of school. We had to stay home until it blew over a little. Once we were back in school, we had security outside all day. And if I went to a sleepover at a friend's house, security would sit outside all night there too. My mom was really affected by what people wrote about her. She had no siblings to share the burden. Nobody who understood what it truly felt like. In a way, she was the princess of America and didn't want to be. Her reluctance only made the chase more interesting for the press. There were photographers and trees. My dad was always pushing or fighting some paparazzo. She genuinely tried her whole life to get away from it, and yet she paradoxically fell in love with Michael Jackson. Once Michael came into our lives, the fame grew exponentially. I don't think anyone fully anticipated the scale of it. My mother certainly didn't. She rarely thought about consequences. Michael and my mom got married in the Dominican Republic 20 days after her divorce from my father. She told Playboy magazine later that she didn't even tell her mom about it until Priscilla called her and said, "There are helicopters flying over my house, driving me crazy. They're saying that you married Michael Jackson." My mom just said, "Yep, I did."
I was actually so happy. I've never been that happy again. We got married in the Dominican Republic on the DL. There were two witnesses. And then it was just the two of us, alone. We'd run from rented house to rented house. We'd get into so much trouble. Sometimes he'd call for his main security guy to come hang out with us, but we would end up ditching him because we just wanted to be on our own, to the point where we'd wander into dangerous areas that we shouldn't have been in. But we just wanted to be alone, to be normal, anonymous. I'd do his laundry and we'd do errands together and shop. For our honeymoon, we rented a quaint little house in the gay neighborhood of Orlando, and we'd walk around and look at real estate and go to Disney World every other day. He wasn't doing any drugs at that point. We were up all night talking sober. Michael was an amazing conversationalist. He was someone who never wanted to talk about himself, hated it, in fact. So he would always divert. He was super interested in people and could really lift them up. He would do anything he could to turn a conversation back to you and what you were doing. He'd be deeply fascinated by everything you had to say about what you did. There was an energy there, something about him that was truly remarkable, something that I've never, ever seen or felt in my entire life other than with my dad. I feel really, really lucky that he let me in. I fell in love with him because he was normal, just fucking normal. His normal was a side that no one saw. His mom would say, "He told you that stuff?" And Janet would say, "I have never heard him talk about anything like that." I wish that he would show that side more. He didn't really talk to his brothers much at that point, and I think they were surprised that our relationship was legit, but they thought it was really cool. No one had ever seen him with his guard down. I knew that it was rare. With everyone else, he would snap his fingers if somebody brought up anything he didn't like. Snap, and you're out. Because he could create his own world, and in that world, everyone had to agree with what he said. But in our world, I would say what I felt, and he loved that about me because it wasn't aimed at him. I could be real without hiding anything. He knew I was a lioness with my children, with anybody I loved. He'd have me deal with people, be the bad cop. He respected how and what I felt. And he usually agreed with me regarding people around him and the shit that was going on. Well, he loved that part of me until we started fighting, and I aimed my honesty at him, which was at the end.
Michael lived with us at Hidden Hills. Sometimes we'd stay at Neverland too, but mostly he was at our house. In Hidden Hills, the call of wild coyotes would send me to sleep. But in Neverland, I would wake up to a pet giraffe outside my window. At home, they were a regular married couple. They would drive us to school together in the morning, just like a normal family, though sometimes Michael would bring along a chimpanzee. Before you ask, 'twas not Bubbles. He would often sing to us. To my mom, he'd sing the Bart Simpson song, "Happy Birthday, Lisa." To Ben, he'd sing "Ben," his first ever solo number one hit. And to me, he would sing, "You Are Not Alone." One day, Ben was on the oak tree swing in his diaper. He often only wore his diaper or no clothes at all. And he was going really high. He was shouting, look, Mimi," wanting to show Michael how high he was swinging, wanting to impress him. But Michael was busy playing with me. My brother fell off backward and hit his head on the ground and began to cry. We all ran over to check on him. The next day, he decided to poop under the swing in protest. After her marriage to Michael, my mother traveled with 10 security guards. When we would drive around, people would throw their bodies at our car, smashing into the windows, screaming, trying to grab us. My brother turned to me one time and said excitedly, "They're following us." I snapped at him, "They're following Mimi." We weren't allowed to go outside without a hat or sunglasses on. I'm not sure what they thought that would achieve, but I remember hearing my mom and Michael laughing so hard one day as I walked into her closet to find her trying on a ridiculous long red wig. They both had wigs on, all in the vain hope that she and Michael could go into the real world without being recognized. My mother and Michael were always very sassy with each other. They talked to each other the same way that Delta talked, or Patsy. Both brought with them generational addiction issues. and both of their families came up from poverty, too. Vernon had been a sharecropper and carpenter, Joe Jackson a crane operator. And both Michael and my mother's father knew all too well what it was like to have godlike fame, a fame that seemed to have appeared overnight. My mom was very comfortable around Michael's family. She loved having dinner at Havenhurst with them. Michael really wanted kids with my mom from the minute they got together, but she never felt certain about it. She didn't have that feeling she had with my father. Whether to have children was a fundamental conflict in their marriage from the start. I know that once in a while Michael would say, "If you're not going to have children with me, then I'm going to find somebody who will." He would also say, "Debbie Rowe told me she will have my children." To which my mom would respond jealously, "Then go fuck Debbie Rowe." All I knew of Debbie was that she was a kind lady who helped me with my ear infections.
When Michael had called me after the allegations, what he told me at the time was that Evan Chandler, the father of one of the accusers, was extorting him. And I think I told Michael to settle it. Everyone advised that he settle because it was going to be a fucking nightmare. As for child molestation, I never saw a goddamn thing like that. I personally would have killed him if I had. I didn't want to be on the front lines, didn't want to make any kind of headlines. I grew up avoiding it and hating the press. I did the interview with Diane Sawyer in 1995 to protect him. I thought he needed me, and I loved that. It was really nice for me to be able to play the female role for once, where I could take care of my husband. After that interview, I got sued by Chandler because Michael had signed a confidentiality agreement with him and had been coached to not approach the subject. But I'd never signed anything. So I would go right in and say that the allegations were not true, and that's how I got the lawsuit. It went all the way down to the deposition stage, but I won. In 1995, Michael released his story. I was in the studio with him all the time he was making it. When it came time to do the pre-press, it was clear the pressure was on him. I started noticing differences in him.
For about a year, they were riding the high of being newly in love. And then things went downhill. My mother started sensing there was drug use on Michael's part, and she started seeing behaviors that she recognized from her father. He began to be more secretive around her. She told me that she thought he was protecting his addiction. At the time, my mom was very anti-drug. She would go on to march in the streets of D.C. to protest the use of psychiatric medicine in children. When she started asking more questions about his addiction, it would cause a lot of friction. They began fighting a lot, and he would ice her for days. I know there was a really bad fight. Somebody threw a plate of fruit at somebody. They were two big spirits, and they both had big tempers. Paranoia grew in both of them, and they were surrounded by people whispering in their ears. During the 1994 MTV Video Music Awards, she had no idea he was going to kiss her until right before it happened. Eventually, the thought crept into her mind. Did he just do that for press? Was he just another version of her first love who had sold photos from the park? It sparked a fear that maybe he was only around because she was Elvis's daughter. A novelty. She no longer trusted him. She believed Michael no longer trusted her either, and he felt that she was catching on to his addiction. Her distrust of the people around her only grew. At some point, Michael disappeared for days, and my mom couldn't find him. She was reaching out to his circle, but no one would tell her anything.
Michael started going to the doctor's office a lot. I'd pick him up and he would be really out of it. I think it was Demerol shots. He said he needed it because of his scalp injury, but I knew there was a longer story to it, that it was big. One of his family members told me that it was a pill habit. He was about to do a giant HBO thing, and I think he didn't want to do it, so he feigned a fall and went to the hospital. I kept asking what was wrong with him, and I got a different answer every day. Karen, his makeup artist, told me that he totally planned it because he didn't want to do the HBO thing. I flew to New York, where he was in the hospital, and was with him every day. His mom was there too, along with his team, including his own anesthesiologist. Nobody has their own anesthesiologist. every hospital has their own. It was a big red flag. At first, I couldn't get a read on what the fuck was going on, but I started to cotton on to it. He needed somebody around who could legally administer the drugs. I told one of the security team that I wanted to go into his bathroom to see what he was taking. A family member asked me to try to get his urine to test it, but I didn't. Michael was being really awful. He got mad at me for asking questions. I said, "What's really happening here? If you have a problem, I'll go with you to rehab." The doctor started coming after me, threatening me, telling me to stop asking so many questions. I said, "I'm just trying to find out what's going on with my husband." The doctor and Michael had a meeting, and when the doctor came out of his room, he said, "He wants to talk to you." In the room, Michael said, "You're causing too many problems here. They're going to take you to the airport. You need to go home until I'm done. I'll see you when I get back." So I left. I wanted him to come too, but he didn't. I filed for divorce very shortly thereafter.
Somebody had told my mom that Michael was planning on filing for divorce, but that it would be better for her if she did it first. My mom told Oprah in 2010 that she made the decision to walk because she saw the drugs and the doctors coming in, and they scared her and put her right back into what she went through with her father. So she filed. But the truth was, Michael never intended to file. It was Romeo and Juliet, the poison mistakenly drunk. Michael was incredibly hurt, and my mom tried and tried to reach him, calling and writing him, but he refused to speak to her. My mom always said that was how she learned to ice people, from Michael. Eventually, they started talking again and hanging out. They had a back and forth, sort of toxic relationship going on. He told her he was going to marry Debbie because he wanted kids. Their divorce was finalized in August 1996, and Michael married Debbie 3 months later. But we'd still go to Neverland. I'm not really sure what the vibe was between my mother and Michael. I don't know if they were still hooking up or not, but we were certainly over there a lot.
We went back and forth for years. He had wanted me to have his children so badly, and I didn't want to. I knew he ultimately wanted to be the only caretaker of the children. Michael wanted to control things. He didn't want a mother influence or any other influence, in fact. I figured that Michael would have me have the children and then dump me, get me out of the picture. I could read him like a clock. I understood everything and I knew everything about him because all we did was bare our souls to one another. I knew his nature, and he was very controlling and calculating. One time he was working and he called me. During the conversation, I said, "You're like a snake. I don't know what you're going to crawl out from under." Michael said, "Oh, that's great." I call home and talk to my wife, and she tells me I'm a snake. Well, I said, "Yeah, you are."
In 1997, my mom flew us all to South Africa, where we watched Michael perform for the last time. We'd sit at the side of the stage while he performed, and he would bring me and some other children out on stage during Heal the World. On the way to the show, our private plane had almost gone down. We made an emergency landing in a village in the middle of nowhere. The near disaster felt like a bad omen to my mom. After South Africa, my mom realized she needed to break off whatever this relationship had become. It wasn't good for her, and she cut Michael out of her life. Years later, Michael called my mom. She said he didn't sound sober. He said, "You were right. Everybody around me wants to kill me." It was their last conversation. My mom was in London writing a record when Michael died. My mom later told Oprah that Michael often said he was afraid of ending up like her father. He was forever asking my mom about when Elvis died, how it happened, where, why. Michael said, "I feel like I'm going to end up the same way." At Michael's funeral, my mother sat with his coffin for hours after everyone left, just like she had with her father. She told Oprah that she didn't think she could make peace, that it was more like she wanted to apologize for not being around. My mom told me that she communicated with Michael through her dreams for months after he died.
He was always really super interested in people, really lift them up, because you're thinking he's Michael Jackson, so he can't do that or whatever. But he can do, he can, I've seen people fall for everyone who gets in his orbit. He'd be really, really interested and fascinated by everything you had to say about what you did. So he would lift people up. I watched him do it all the time. It was amazing. You know, he did it with me.